Good evening, I'm Doug Dibbert, and it's a delight to welcome all of you. I was handed a card by a member of our staff. They were concerned that I might have forgotten it, and the card reads, "Remember, Doug, no one came to hear you speak." The flip side always says, "Blessed are the brief, for they shall be invited back." We're delighted that so many of you returned from last March, and some of the panelists are concerned that you may have actually remembered what they said and might ask a pointed question in one of your opportunities. Cards are being provided. Many of you sent cards in or questions in earlier. We're delighted to have Farrell Guillory, a former editorial page editor of the Raleigh News and Observer, as our moderator. In the interest of having the program proceed without any delay, we are foregoing the lengthy bios that we would typically provide, but believe that each of you who cares can read those in the program. You'll notice that the panelists are seated and they will remain seated for the program. And the questions will be collected, as I said, and handled by Mr. Guillory. So please join me in a warm welcome to a member of the North Carolina Journalism Hall of Fame, an Edward Kidder Graham Public Service Award winner, Professor Farrell Guillory. Farrell?
Well, thank you, Doug, and it's a pleasure to see all of you here. As Doug said, you've got your program here, and there are bios of everyone. Undoubtedly, Becky Gray is caught in traffic driving from Raleigh, but we'll get her on as soon as she arrives. My job as moderator is just to kind of keep the conversation going. All presidential elections are historic in one form or another. We kind of trace our history in one stream of research through our presidents. History helps us understand who the people are who win the highest office in the land, but also what it tells us about us as a people and a society. Several of my students are here, and so I'm going to tell you what I've been telling them. Yeah, I see you back there. Is that they are prone to write in their papers, "This was unprecedented, one of a kind, never before." And I tell them, hold on, history flows. One presidential election leads to another. Things change, but hardly anything is ever totally unique or totally unprecedented. But I also tell them that this election of 2016 has the feel of a really big moment, a big M moment. I cast my first vote in a presidential election in 1968, and my generation, the early part of the baby boom, was defined by the election and then the assassination of President Kennedy and the assassination of his brother and Martin Luther King, civil rights, Vietnam, civil unrest. We had to engage. They were big defining incidents, and this election has that same kind of feel, that we've just got to engage with it. This is not an election to be ignored. It requires a response from each of us as citizens. So we've assembled a panel here of people who can help us think about how to respond, how to engage, and what it means for us as American citizens. And so we've got Bill Luchtenberg, the eminent presidential historian, Bill Marshall, who's worked in the White House and teaches in the law school, Sarah Truel Roberts, who teaches about American politics and Congress, and Hodding Carter, who's been in the State Department as award-winning documentary filmmaker, and most recently a professor of public leadership here at Carolina. I made a big mistake in my life when I was a graduate student at Columbia, I didn't know enough to take Bill Luttenberg's class while he was teaching there. I took class with another historian. So I've been making up for it since he's been here. I let him teach me every now and then. And so we're going to start with Bill Luttenberg, one of the best teachers that there is. Bill?
We were provided ahead of time with a couple of questions that Farrell was going to ask us for us to respond to. And Farrell hasn't asked that question, but...
Just go right ahead. You know what they are.
But the opening question is, what would you say is the most significant lesson learned from 2016? And I think the most significant lesson is that we need to be more wary of prognosticators. And this is the third election in my lifetime where those who foretold what was to happen were wrong. It started out when I was a teenager in the 1936 election, at a time when polling was primitive. That was the year that George Gallup began. But the big figure or the big institution that year wasn't Gallup, but rather a magazine called the Literary Digest, which since 1916 had been forecasting the outcome of presidential races and had never been wrong. In 1932, it had called Franklin Roosevelt's victory margin within 1%. And in 1936, the Literary Digest forecast a disastrous defeat for Franklin Roosevelt at the hands of the Republican candidate, Alf Landon. What happened instead was that FDR won the biggest proportion of the electoral vote of any candidate since James Monroe, more than a century earlier, had run with no opposition. Roosevelt, in that election, carried every one of the then 48 states, save for two, Maine and Vermont. And there was a saying at that time that as Maine goes, so goes the nation. But after the 1936 outcome, the phrase became, as Maine goes, so goes Vermont. The second time in my lifetime was 1948, which is famous for the Chicago Tribune headline of a newspaper released during election night, which Harry Truman loved to hold up. Some of you, I'm sure, have seen it, and says, Dewey defeats Truman. I was in Kansas City that night, working in Richard Bolling's first campaign for Congress. And early in the evening, it became clear that Dick had won, and then other Democrats from around the country phoned in, both to congratulate him and also to announce that they had run successful campaigns. From Illinois, Adlai Stevenson and Paul Douglas. From Minnesota, Hubert Humphrey. From Connecticut, Chet Bowles. From Michigan, Soapy Williams. It appeared to be an enormously successful night for Democratic candidates. But I remember as I was closing up Bowling's office. There were only two of us left. And I said to a young woman on the staff, "It's too bad about Harry, isn't it?" Because all through the night, as we listened to the radio returns, we were told by the foremost newscaster of the day, H.V. Kaltenborn, to keep waiting for the rural returns. Although Truman was ahead, when all the ballots were counted, he would, as predicted, go down to defeat. But once again, as you well know, the forecasters were mistaken, and Harry Truman won election to a new term in his own right. It left pollsters in an acute state of embarrassment. One woman was overheard to say, "Now, I don't even know whether to believe in the Kinsey report." And now we have difficult campaign, to use a quiet word, that we've all witnessed, and the unexpected outcome. Unexpected for Trump pollsters and advisors, as well as those of Hillary Clinton. I think there is, from my first two examples, something pertinent to this year. And that is that people did not think seriously to question, or seriously enough to question, prognostications because they seemed so plausible. It seemed so plausible in 1936 that after one term, the Republicans of out of power, the Republicans would be restored to power, because this, for so long, had been predominantly a Republican country. When Franklin Roosevelt won in 1932, he was the first Democrat to enter the White House with a popular majority, that is to say, more than 50%, since Franklin Pierce 80 years before. It's hard to believe, but in 1924, in the great populous state of California, the Democratic presidential candidate got only 10% of the vote. So the notion that the Republicans would come back seemed, as I say, not at all out of the question, despite Franklin Roosevelt's popularity. And hence, credence was given when more questioning would have been in order. Much the same was true in 1948. In the first midterm elections, after Harry Truman succeeded FDR, in the 1946 midterm elections, the slogan of the Republicans was, "To err is Truman." And in the meat shortage, this is horse meat, Harry. The United States News and World Report in 1946 pontificated, "Harry Truman is a one-termer." Only 2 years later was the presidential election, and there seemed little reason to dispute that, since he had not been doing well for much of his term. There seemed to be little prospect that he was going to be elected. But there were a couple of other elements to it too, and that was that he was running with both wings of his party broken off from him. The left wing of the party rallying behind Henry Wallace's progressives, the racist Deep South wing of his party behind Strom Thurmond and the Democrats. If it seemed improbable that Truman would win in 1948 with the United Democratic Party, what possible chance could he have with two wings of his party broken away? In the fall of 1946, Newsweek asked the 60 leading political correspondents in the country what was going to happen, and every one of the 60 predicted Truman's defeat. So when we have a circumstance of plausibility, it's not reasonable to suppose that there is going to be deep questioning of the pollsters, or the prognosticators more generally. And that's what happened again this year. Donald Trump seemed such a mountebank, such a yes. That's the most eloquent thing I could say, is to be at a loss for words to describe the notion early on that he could get the Republican nomination seemed so improbable, and then that he could win seemed so improbable. And as I said on this panel in March, so scary that there was a little disposition to question deeply. So that, Farrell, is what I think I most take out of at this stage this past election.
Well, thank you, Bill. I was in such a rush to heed Doug's admonition to keep it short that I forgot to pose the questions. But all the panelists have gotten the questions. Becky Gray, we are delighted to have you here.
Thank you.
From John Locke Foundation. And if you've caught your breath, it'll be okay. Your turn. The two questions that we kind of seeded or prompted the panel to address, as Bill just said, what would you say is the most significant lesson learned from 2016? And then the second one is similar to the first. What were the key factors that drove the outcome both in North Carolina and across the country? Hoping that those two questions would give the panelists a wide berth to offer their analysis. So, Becky, it's your turn.
Thank you so much. First of all, let me apologize for being late. I tell you, there was a terrible accident on I-40 as I was coming out of Raleigh. So I would just, you know, caution everyone, be careful when you're out there. But I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for the invitation to join you all for this interesting panel on post-election. As we're all kind of trying to dig our way out of here, I think we're still asking what happened. Some of the most significant lessons that I sort of gleaned from this were, first of all, North Carolina is still very much a purple state. You know, as you know, you all know, we got so much attention during this election because nobody really knew which way North Carolina was going to go. We're such a highly contested state. Of the 12 gubernatorial races across the country, ours was the most closely contested. And as you know, I mean, we still don't really know who the winner is going to be in that. I think we probably know who the winner is. We just don't know that it's all official yet. So that's probably, you know, the first thing is that, you know, I was not surprised, but that North Carolina continues to be extremely competitive. And as we're digging out of this, what I'm hearing from my friends who are more involved in the political part of things are saying that North Carolina is going to continue to be this competitive. So if you like all those political ads and all those direct mail pieces that you got and all the attention that North Carolina here got over the last year and a half, get ready because it's going to start again. You know, a couple other things that I learned were all bets are off. I think during this election we saw that rules about campaigns sort of expected behavior, expected demeanor, you know, all of those things that we have over the years sort of come to expect, all bets are off and this is a whole new ball game. I think that we saw that in many different factors, but not the least of which, I thought that the Twitter and all of the activity on social media was really a good example of that. I think that President Obama in 2008 was kind of the first that I saw of a lot of this being conducted on social media and campaigns really keying into that and that population that pays attention to social media. And I think that we saw that even more so with Donald Trump on Twitter, and even as the president-elect now is conducting a lot of news that we're getting on Twitter. I think that it's also been accepted as a given in the past that certain states were going to be red states and certain states are blue states. And then there's just a few states that are really competitive, like North Carolina. And I did commentary on election night on television and then was on the radio until 2 o'clock in the morning. And as we were watching those returns come in, it was really interesting because there were certain states that everybody had said these will be Hillary Clinton states for sure. And as they came in, they switched. And so I think some of those assumptions are no longer valid. You know, again, we'll continue to see those changes. I think that nationally what happens, kind of some of the key factors, first of all, I think we have the two most unpopular candidates for president that we had ever had. You know, I think in many cases it became when voters went to the poll to cast their vote, they were voting not for the other person rather than whoever it was that they were really supporting. I think nationally that people rejected a lot of the Obama administration's policies and the Democratic insiders and what many people saw as Washington insiders. And I think that in many ways, this election was a comment on that, on broken promises that had been made, that had not been fulfilled. You know, what we saw was, you know, Hillary promised more of the same with the Obama administration and really represented what we had had for 8 years, whereas Trump came in and said he was going to blow things up. And again, you know, it was one of those where a lot of people just voted for the other guy, the other one that they didn't like. And then just real quick, I was also really surprised as I was getting ready for this and really kind of thinking, what are the real takeaways and some of the key factors? One of the other things I was really surprised at was the strength of the Republicans during this election and here in North Carolina. I think many people were surprised. I know I was surprised that Donald Trump won the presidency. As you know, the U.S. House and the U.S. Congress both maintained or now have control by the Republicans. Of the 12 governor's races that we had across the country, before the election, 8 of those were held by Democrats, 4 were held by Republicans. After the election, it's 5 Democrat governors, 6 Republican governors, and then 1 ours here in North Carolina is still undecided. Here in North Carolina, of course, our U.S. Senate seat will remain in Republican hands with Richard Burr. 10 of the 13 congressional states in North Carolina are represented by Republicans in Washington. 6 of our 9 Council of State races, of Council of State positions, are represented by Republicans. That's the highest, I think, that it's ever been. Republicans picked up 3 of those new seats with treasurer, insurance commissioner, and superintendent of public instruction. The North Carolina House lost a net of 1 seat. They maintained their supermajority in the North Carolina House. In the North Carolina Senate, they picked up a net of 1 seat for Republicans. So Republicans hold supermajorities in both the North Carolina House and the North Carolina Senate. Of course, we don't know about the governor's race, but just taking it just even a little bit deeper, the county commissions across North Carolina, not all county commissions in all 100 counties had elections, but of those that did, Republicans picked up 3 county commission seats, Democrats picked up 2. So before the election, there were 53 Republican county commissions, 46 Democrat. After the election, there are now 54 Republican county commissions, 45 Democrat. And just to kind of put that in perspective, after the 2008 election, 64 of our county commissions were controlled by Democrats, 36 were controlled by Republicans. So you can see from the very top all the way down to the local elections in North Carolina that this was really a very, very strong year from Republicans. And I think that we'll be talking about for months and months after this why that is, what that really means, and then, of course, what that's going to look like going forward.
All right. As I was walking in, the News and Observer that I get emailed to me is reporting that the State Board of Elections has given the Durham Board until 7 p.m. Monday to finish the recount. So maybe we'll know something by the end of the day Monday. We can only hope.
Right.
My friend Bill Marshall is next, who has had experience in Ohio in state politics and then Washington and in the White House, and is a distinguished professor of the law here at Chapel Hill. Bill, great
thanks,
to have you.
Thanks, Farrell. It's great to be with this great panel. I'll tell you what the lesson should not be, but a lot of people are taking, is that there are 60 million bad people in the United States, no matter which side they voted for this time. That is one of the lessons that people are taking, and I think it's the wrong one to take. I don't think that's true. I think there are a lot of reasons why the vote went that it did. We had one candidate who ran against the establishment, literally, and the other candidate who ran against that candidate. Both of them might have done fairly well if they remembered it's the economy, stupid. And I think that the second candidate, the one who ran against the establishment, or the first one, the one who ran against the establishment, had more of an economic theme to what he was saying than the other one did. And it was one of picking up on resentment, and a resentment of how some folks who are telling those in the center of the country how to run their lives have gotten very rich while they're telling folks in the center of the country that they need retraining. And that is not necessarily a good lesson to learn. I'm going to get to that in a minute. But I think that the actual lesson of this one is a continuing one, that it is the economy, and that is the number one thing that motivates voters. Now, why did the election come out the way it did? I think that a couple of nuances that I would get is, one is media has changed, and this is a very different world we live in right now. If you watched certain media, all you heard about was Donald Trump's womenizing and racist statements. If you watched other media, all you heard about was Hillary Clinton's lies and deceptions. And the media that I'm talking about isn't just Fox News versus MSNBC, it's social media. And particularly social media, which was doing a lot of just echo chambering, if I can make up a new verb, with what people wanted to hear anyway. So there really wasn't the kind of engagement that you would see normally among ideas. People were just going to reinforce their own particular ideas. And I don't know what's going to change that. I don't know what forces there are to change it. What we've seen is, and this relates to that, what we've seen is a discrediting of mainstream media so that nobody believes what mainstream media has to say anymore. And what does that do but just open up an avenue where lies are perfectly acceptable? As one person I heard recently said, we are so democratic in the United States, we believe that everybody is entitled to their own set of facts. And that is pretty much where we've gone to. There is no referee there that says at one point that something is just simply wrong, even if it is a factual statement. And that kind of background leads to outrageous things being said and leads to a demagoguery that is dangerous no matter which side you're in. It has a tendency often to work for one way or another, but it's a dangerous kind of phenomenon that we have to deal with going forward. The other thing that I think that, the other point I want to make, because I want to hear what the other speakers have to say too, is that there is something fundamentally wrong with the Democratic Party. If you think that this election is all about racism and sexism, think again. A lot of the states that voted for Donald Trump voted for Obama twice. A lot of people who voted for Donald Trump voted for Obama twice. In 1988, one of the few states that voted for Dukakis was West Virginia. In that same election, California, Illinois, Ohio, and Pennsylvania voted Republican. When West Virginia becomes one of the first and most Republican states in the nation, something has gone wrong with what the Democratic Party was built upon. And the Democratic Party has to come to grips with that in order to move forward. I think the Republican Party has an issue too. I don't think the election can be explained purely by racism and sexism. But there's no question that the Republicans have to be concerned about the racist and sexist aspects of people who are following what they are doing and pushing that, and they have to figure out a way to deal with that component, because they have certainly gotten the benefit of some of that. But again, I think it's completely incorrect to describe this election on those terms. Middle America feels, and I was out doing canvassing, middle America feels incredibly abandoned by the policies of all of Washington, not just the Democratic policies, and particularly the economic policies that haven't seemed to respond to their needs.
Thank you, Bill. Now we go to Sarah Truel Roberts, who's an expert on Congress and voting behavior, and is a part of the generation of scholars upon which the future of our university rests. So we're going to put it on your shoulders, Sarah.
Shoulders just got heavy. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This is the first time I've sat on a panel, and after November 8th, there obviously have been numerous panels that I've been a part of, where I haven't had to be the person that had to sort of abscond with the xenophobia, misogyny, and racism line. And so I say that for two reasons, the first one being you're all attending a brilliant panel. And then the second one is that there has been so much attention post November 8th into those themes and having people discuss what this means. Is the underbelly of America truly that ugly? Is our country full of millions of people who are misogynist, are racist, are xenophobic? And the answer to that is perhaps, right? There certainly were people that voted probably under those terms or in that context, but that's not why Trump won the election, to echo what's been said before. And I think it's really important that we keep that in mind as we move forward. There are very good reasons, even though you might disagree with them, for reasons that Trump won the election, why he won the nomination. The biggest one is party identification. People in this country vote a party ID, and they vote their party ID with religious regularity. And it's hard to break people of that habit, even if when polled, perhaps inaccurately, they say that they're going to, or that they're not going to vote for Donald Trump. They get into the voting booth and they say, but I'm a Republican, and of course I'm going to vote for the Republican nominee. Couple that with the fact that Democrats didn't turn out in this election in the same numbers they have been in the past, and you're going to end up with a Trump presidency. It's sort of, you know, meant to be in some ways. But so the reason that I think when I pay attention to this election and what happened, and I'm trying to dissect it in the same ways that so many people are, is the primary reason, of course, is the Electoral College, right? And I am not against the Electoral College by any stretch of the imagination. I study American political institutions, and I believe in our institutions, democracy, the Electoral College, the Senate, the filibuster, all of them. And I think it's a great institution, but that is, in and of, at the end of the day, why Trump is our president. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. In fact, the Democratic Party has won 6 out of the last 7 elections with regards to the popular vote in this country. So I agree with Professor Marshall that the Democratic Party has a problem. They also still have a lot of voters, even though they didn't have a lot of voters turn out. So what we need to take into context then, as we move forward, is think about what Clinton did wrong. Why did she lose those firewall states of Wisconsin, of Michigan, and of Pennsylvania? Also, you could lump in Ohio and Iowa, but she didn't actually need those. But she did need Wisconsin, she did need Michigan, she did need Pennsylvania. And what happened? And I would simply echo what people have said up here previously, that they didn't pay attention to the economy. They didn't pay attention to rural America. They didn't pay attention to working class America. And then I think you couple that with a bigger problem that she paid so much attention to, and her campaign paid so much attention to, the misogyny, the racism, the xenophobiaism, that people stopped thinking about what Hillary Clinton and what the Democratic Party was standing for and the policies they were putting forward. She became convinced, or her campaign rather, became convinced at some point that it was going to be enough to just say, don't vote for him, and that that would win her the election. And if she could just remind people what a terrible human being he was, that she would clearly be victorious. And that's what the polls were sort of indicating too. But that's not what happened. Go back to party line voting. People wanted a plan, especially rural America, especially the working class America. They wanted to know how their life would be better, how in 4 years things would be improved, why their job would be back, what was going to happen, how immigrants were no longer going to take their job, what was going to be improved. And even if it wasn't always factual, as has been mentioned before, there was a plan put forward every day by the Trump campaign. They were going to build a wall. They were going to keep jobs in America. They were going to find people who left jobs or took jobs away. They were going to remove us from trade agreements. There was a plan put forward by the Trump campaign, and even though you could tell me that Hillary Clinton had a better plan, it was never discussed. And for that simple reason, which is in some ways campaign 101, the campaign fell flat, and people couldn't figure out why they should turn out to vote for Hillary Clinton, keeping in mind, as was already said earlier, these are two already unpopular candidates. So she didn't have that going for her, and then with the lack of a plan, people just felt there was no reason to vote for the Democratic Party. Then you couple that with political science literature that goes back in time, and speaking of history, as I am not the person best suited on this panel to do, but speaking of history, if you look back, it is very hard for a party to win consecutive White Houses. You have to go back to the Reagan presidency, followed by one term of a Bush presidency, for that to be the last case and the last time that that happened. It's really hard, and this is what the Clinton campaign suffered from, to make a change argument and to be the vice for change and say, I can make things better, when you are the problem already, right? And that's not her fault, right? That's simply that her party brand name was the Democratic Party. And she couldn't walk in there and say, I'm gonna do things differently, especially with President Obama campaigning for her all the time. Right? And I don't think that was a mistake on his part necessarily, but it clearly tied her to what was already happening in Washington. And that's going to hurt when you're trying to sell to people, especially the middle class America, that is hurting, that she was going to make things different. There was no clear plan in place. So when we talk about the middle of America, what really are we talking about? I think there's two problems here. So if you look at figures of global income in the world, and also if you look at US income, what we tend to be talking about here is the middle three-fifths, right? Things have gotten better, though don't tell them that because they wouldn't agree with you, for the bottom fifth of Americans during the Obama presidency. And things have certainly improved and continue to improve for the top fifth of the American electorate. But that middle three-fifths is losing in real income dollars. And those are the people that turned out to vote for Trump. And they turned out in new numbers, right? People who weren't turning out before said, this matters to me and I need change. Whereas the Democrats stayed home. There's been great stories in the New York Times and other publications following up on what happened in the election. And some people are turning particular attention to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Wisconsin being part of that firewall that was needed, Wisconsin being a clear victory for the Democratic Party in the eyes of that party moving forward, and of course that's not at all what happened there. Hillary Clinton never once went to the entire state of Wisconsin. Right? That's unbelievable, and that's a huge mistake on behalf of a campaign. Furthermore, you dig into Milwaukee and you dig into what was sort of happening there, there's probably two explanations. One is that Wisconsin had a strict voter ID requirement, and no doubt that played some role. Right? I don't want to throw out any numbers. There aren't numbers. We might never know. But that does play some role. Then you dive into these publications that the New York Times is putting out and some surveys that have been done, and you hear stories of people in Wisconsin, and particularly in Milwaukee, very poor places in Milwaukee, saying, why would I turn out? Nothing has changed. Nothing has been better. These are African American communities that are saying, it's wonderful that now I can show my son or show my daughter that there can be an African American president. But that African-American president did absolutely nothing for me. Why would I turn out and vote in an election 4 years later for more of the same party? Now, these people didn't vote for Trump, but they're not turning out to help the Democratic Party either. So I think these are real concerns that we need to think about moving forward. We really need to figure out a way to connect with middle America. And I mean Democrats and Republicans together, because even though Republicans ended up voting for Trump, they might be in for a rude awakening when they try to figure out that Donald Trump most likely, despite what he's talking about in Indiana and Ohio right now, is most likely not keeping most of those jobs here. He's not going to build a wall. Congress is not going to pay for a wall, right? There are going to be realities of a Trump presidency that are not met. And that's where I think as we move forward, we're going to have to say, okay, what is it about this new campaign world where people can just espouse ideas and espouse promises but not follow through on them? Are there consequences? And I think that'll be very interesting to see as we move forward.
Thank you, Sarah. In the, what is it, Hodding, 10 years or so you've been in Chapel Hill, I think I've introduced Hodding every other week. I've run out of words to introduce my friend and colleague, Hodding Carter. So I'm just going to say, here's Hodding.
Seldom in doubt, rarely correct, okay? I mean, and there are many who understand that about me. And in the process of participating over these years, I may not have been all the way around the globe, but I've gone pretty far around it. So let me start at the bottom and get up to the big picture later. This is just a statement of fact. State by state, area by area, the Republicans have been taking over this country's governance. Having been the non-governance party for so long, they are now the governance party. They are the people who run, as we just heard the figures, and they've been doing it because we are too smart to work at that level. And I'm now speaking as a liberal Democrat of the national scale. We have not tended to our knitting. I would love to believe that this time finally got our attention, but nothing has up until now. Literally has not. The big money always goes to the biggest races, and at the level at which people run county government, at which the level they take legislatures and the like, we have not been doing our homework, and I'm now speaking as a partisan Democrat. And on this one, this is a long-term refrain from me, and I'm going to keep it up, because you don't win repeatedly from the top down if you're losing everything from the bottom up. You don't rebuild a national party that way. And rebuilding the party is necessary. Second, demography is not destiny. No matter how many times we have been saying that in the Democratic Party, that the new coloration of America was going to change the way politics went, the reality is, of course, whatever your color, if in fact what government is producing is not producing for you, it does not excite you enough to go out just because somebody pats you on the head and says, I'm on your side. Saying you're on your side, if you are brown or black or anything, including white, and discovering that that is not true, does not encourage a great deal of participation for a party. But lack of turnout's numbers can be explained to some degree by the fact that, of course, the candidate this time was not brown or black or however you want to describe colors, which I always find amusing since we're purple. But be that as it may, it was not unexpected that this turnout would fall off. What is going to be difficult is to know why it's going to improve. Next thing. It is not true that I beat up on every new generation. The fact that I'm furious that I'm not the new generation notwithstanding, and that I wish to blame constantly the fecklessness of youth. But the youth in this election were feckless. They weren't, in fact, on the first time around for Obama. It doesn't matter. Won't go through this. But the lack of turnout of the so-called millennials was a devastating thing, but it speaks to an overwhelming problem, which is they wish to follow the Pied Piper, and the Pied Piper having not succeeded, they did not wish to participate at levels which were necessary also for a Democratic victory. And I say this now as a grandfather of 10 grandchildren who are voters, and who had to be literally browbeaten by their parents after Bernie lost to participate in this general election. They were furious. Now, they are heartsick today, but that doesn't matter, not knowing enough about history or the present, for that matter. They thought that pouting was a good way for some time. They didn't pout, but a lot did. When I got to this state, I discovered a horrible thing. What had been considered a test case for smart handling of school integration, which was over there in the neighboring Wake County, had just been repudiated by the voters in turning out the Republican majority on the school board and electing a board which was going to do away with the whole notion of economic allocation as opposed to racial and that sort of thing in schools. The turnout in that election, a fundamental election, does somebody remember what the turnout was for that? 5%. 5%. Go look it up. Of the potential voters. And then, of course, we on my side all ran around baying at the moon and crying and saying the world is coming to an end. We didn't know how much the world was coming to an end, but we certainly found out that if you don't vote, it comes to an end. And that very fine experiment over there went away, at least for a while. Now, I tend to be extremely pessimistic, as many people on this panel know, and that's because I grew up in Mississippi. But what makes me even more pessimistic is that increasingly the folks who represent us in office and the folks who vote also remind me of Mississippi all over this country. All of you are now rushing around to give the voters who voted for Trump a pass because they have been deprived by economics, they've been deprived by lousy leadership. How many of you all teach? How many in this place have taught? You're responsible. I mean, look, it requires total cognitive dissonance to vote for Trump on the basis you hear illustrated as the reasons that they voted for him. There is nothing in his record in any way indicating that he gives a good damn about the average guy, that his businesses, which are all low-wage businesses, God save us if you think hospitality employment is going to save your economy, which is what South Florida thought for a long time. But it's not, and they got to know it in their daily lives. And why can't you add up one and one and get two instead of getting zero and voting for Trump? I fully appreciate, God knows I fully appreciate, that nobody should trust a Democratic Party as encrusted as ours is with the various hangings of special interest groupings in which the main thing we know how to do well is to divide up our platforms and our programs so everybody thinks their back has been scratched without scratching the very large back. And going to your point is the point, which is the economy, and offering something which makes some sense. I think one of the finest guys I've known in public life has been our current president, a fine man. I have to say this just as a fact. I see that, as far as I'm concerned, he did not have a clue about what to do on the economic front. And if he did, the Republicans were busy proving that you can make a kitchen look like hell if you break all the crockery. And they spent a good part of his time breaking everything up and then saying, look how sloppy this is, how terrible this is. But you know, you don't have to lose on that one. And Harry Truman proved it. I think my friend is standing up and saying, shut up. So Harry Truman proved it. You can run against the guys if you keep saying, and he did over and over again. He represented what it was the people needed, while all of his opponents were saying any number of things, which made it apparently impossible for him to govern. I'll stop and say one other thing. Don't run around foaming at the mouth because the presidential candidate who won didn't get a majority of the popular vote. It is rare that the people we care most about outside of the four Roosevelt terms got a majority of the popular vote. Majority of the popular vote. Bill Clinton never got a majority of the popular vote, okay, just to put that in your pocket. And nor, of course, well, it doesn't matter. You can go do the math. But we've been a long time since a majority came for us, with the exception, again, of this last time. And having proved he could get majorities, we didn't deliver. And we didn't deliver it when we could have, which was in the first term of the Obama years. Look it up. We had majorities in both houses. And what did we get? Yes, I'm through. Sorry, friend.
Thank you, bud.
I couldn't remember what the questions were, frankly.
Well, I'm gonna give you a chance to talk some more because I have some questions. I've got a summary of the questions that you wrote on the cards. And Catherine, if I can bother you again, if you can bring me some specific cards as I go through, I'll ask specific questions. But the questions here are categorized: general questions, social questions, political questions, Trump questions, Clinton questions. And I'm going to go, because he's the president-elect, to the Trump questions. I'm going to combine a couple of them here. Thank you. And you know, I'll throw it out to the panel. Any of you can do it. What about the checks and balances? How do we think about the Trump presidency in terms of checks and balances? Congress, Supreme Court. How do we think about the Trump presidency based on his campaign in the view of many, including me, flouting constitutional principles? So how do we think about the challenges and the barriers that he faces going forward?
Bill. No, I want to speak.
There was a book called Opinions of Oliver Alston, in which the figure was an imaginary social commentator said that there were certain phrases in the history books that made all thought stop for him. He suddenly became numb. And one of them was the resumption of specie payments, when he came on that in an American history textbook. And the phrase checks and balances is another one that numbs me rather than moves me to thinking constructively about something. If we ask seriously about the two institutions that Trump will deal with, one of the unfortunate, I think, outcomes of his victory is that he has the opportunity to shape the United States Supreme Court. And so it's not as though this is an institution that stands as a check to him over which he has no control. He has a vacancy right at the moment, since we have only an 8-member United States Supreme Court. So it's more of an avenue of opportunity at this point than a check on him. In Congress, we've heard of the considerable Republican success in the House, which was not a surprise. The only change in the other direction is in the United States Senate, where the Democrats did pick up two seats. Last year, I spoke at a prestigious prep school in New England and had dinner with the headmaster and his wife. This is Philip Sexeter in New Hampshire. And the wife of the headmaster, whom Jean Ann and I had dinner with, was the governor of the state, Maggie Hassan, who was, I thought, a very impressive delightful person, and is now the United States Senator from New Hampshire. That's one of the two seats. The other, the seat in Illinois. So there is a slight movement for the opposition party to Trump, but I don't think that's going to have any considerable difference. The only problem he will have is if he, as was said about the building a wall, which he seems to be receding from anyway, if he has a program that requires massive appropriations that run against the disposition of the Republican majority in Congress to vote them, then he's going to have some difficulty. Might I say something else?
Sure.
I was thinking before this question came up that no panel works very well unless there's dissent. And so I wanted a dissent about some of the things that I've been hearing said from my distinguished colleagues. We're at a point where there are a series of narratives around the country about why the election turned out as it did, and not all of those narratives are credible, even though they keep on being repeated. Given how inglorious the record of those of us who work in political analysis has been of predicting the outcome of this election, modesty would not be ill taken when we're asked to say what the reason is for an election that we didn't predict. Here, I have in my hand a document from CNN. Only those of you in the front row, even though it's large type, might be able to read at all what it says. But it says, how did Trump win? Here are 24 theories. And some of the theories seem to me improbable. For example, if the country was passing judgment, negative judgment on Obama, and if there was a widespread economic rebellion in the country, then how does it happen that Obama ran 2 million votes behind his opponent? If there was a huge feeling of anger in the country, a resentment that needed expression at the polls, then why was there such a low turnout? This was a changeover election, a very unusual one when you get change without an increase in turnout. The question of whether it's not the Republican success but the Democratic failure, which has been expressed, is something I'm also skeptical about. Take this matter of West Virginia. It's quite correct, as my colleague says, that this is has been an extraordinarily stable Democratic state for a very long time. There was a point, I think it may have been the 1952 election, when there were only four states in the country that had voted Democratic in six successive presidential elections. Two of them were in the Deep South, One was Massachusetts, and the other was West Virginia. Now, the reason that that Hillary Clinton or any Democratic candidate this year had no chance in West Virginia is that the Democrats, President Obama, for very good reason, thought that environmental quality should not be compromised, and that this meant not having coal of poisoning the air. We can understand why that irritated voters in the state of West Virginia. But if the lesson to Democrats is that they've got to abandon the environment and that they should do so to win back West Virginia, I hope that's a lesson that they will not take up.
All right. Anybody else want to take on? Yeah, Sarah.
Yeah, I'll jump in really fast to go back to the checks and balances of the Trump presidency. And I'll agree with what was said before. And that is to the extent that it's going to be fairly easy in some ways for Trump to do certain things that he wants to do. But I'll disagree to the extent that I don't think the Senate will be as favorable to his policies as was offered earlier. There are many Republican senators right now. First of all, they do have a narrower majority than they did prior to the election. And names like Lindsey Graham or John McCain, Ben Sasser, and even Rand Paul come to mind as people that might not get on board with a complete Trump agenda and Trump appointments. So those are names that you may want to pay attention to as we move forward. I also think the House will be interesting. Prior to the election, people were talking about how the Republican Party was broken. That hasn't changed. There may be a honeymoon period for Donald Trump. There may be a moment when Republicans say our best chance at survival is to jump on the Trump train and go from there. But other than that, the Republican divides are still very real for that party. The fact that Donald Trump wants to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure is not going to go over very well with fiscal conservatives in the House Republican caucus. The Tea Party is still there. The House Freedom Caucus is still there. There will be plenty of checks on a Donald Trump presidency as we move forward in the next 2 years. That being said, Democrats are in trouble in the Senate. So they have an election coming up in 2 years, and the Senate looks to be that the Republicans are defending just 8 seats there, and Democrats will be defending 23 plus the 2 independent seats. And many of those seats are obviously in states that voted for Donald Trump in this last election, unsurprisingly, as so many did. But those states, just to name a few, are Florida, Indiana, Missouri, Montana, North Dakota, Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Wisconsin, all currently held by Democrats and all up for re-election in 2018. So if there is going to be a check on a Donald Trump presidency in the Senate, these are the 2 years for that to shine through. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, there's a problem with which I think that Sarah's exactly right, that I think there's going to be some resistance to Trump. But one of the interesting things, the Constitution, somebody studies the Constitution about presidential power, is people's views change on it on a specific day in January. Every 8 years or so, people who didn't like presidential power suddenly think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and people who oppose presidential power, who opposed it, suddenly think the opposite. What has happened, I think, historically, is that the presidency has become increasingly more powerful. George W. Bush made incredibly broad arguments about inherent presidential power to expand the power of the presidency. President Obama did it slightly different. He made incredibly expansive arguments about statutes and his ability to interpret statutes incredibly broadly. Both of those tools will be used by the next president. They would have been used by Hillary Clinton. They'll be used by Donald Trump. And there's not going to be a lot of easy checks on it. The only good thing that I can tell you about this is that I think that the Supreme Court, which had for many years been very reluctant to get involved in separation of powers issues, has suddenly signaled that it's more likely to get involved in police separation of powers in a way that it hadn't previously. I think part of that is because some of the conservatives on the court were very concerned with what President Obama was doing. And in that sense, President Obama's actions are going to lead to a more diligent Supreme Court. But I think we're likely to see the court a little bit more activist. And that's true, I think, even if President-elect Trump appoints somebody, because I think the point of appointment that he's likely to make is not going to center on separation of powers as much as it is on other constitutional theories. He won't be focused on that. One of the interesting things, I think Sarah's right with a lot of what she's saying, but I do think it's interesting to see that other than the infrastructure, it's interesting to see how this administration is developing. It's developing as a Mike Pence administration, which is a conservative Republican administration with a little bit of populist rhetoric at the top. And if that's true, then I think we're going to see the Republicans fall into line in a much, much more significant way than we've seen. I think we'll see I think the infrastructure one is a good point. I think we'll see Donald Trump fighting to get jobs here and there when Carrier wants to leave. But I think primarily what we're going to see is a very traditional conservative Republican administration from where things are right now. So if that is true, then a Republican majority is going to work with the president. One quick point. Recently, a very influential article was written about how we have moved from a country of separation of powers to a country of separation of parties, in which parties see their futures so aligned with the success of their leader that they will fall behind them no matter what. And that pressure is going to be there because Republicans in the Congress and the Senate will see their own political fortunes tied to how well the particular president does. Now, if Trump starts going offline a bit, maybe they'll rebel. But if it's a Mike Pence administration, I don't think we're going to see much resistance.
You know, I'm always amused in the beginning of a new administration in which people saying the better angels will prevail and it won't be doing what he said he was going. He's going to do what he said he was going to do. He's going to offer up a succession of proposals, but they will come first, as was just suggested, on the big money side. He's going to reflect the needs of the people who he reflects. I mean, forget his demagoguery. What he is about is making money in the most obscene sorts of ways, but which essentially depend on manipulation of financial systems, and including bankruptcy, to get there. And so he's going to offer it up, and they're going to pass it. It's not any question in my mind about it. And watching a few people slinking around in my party already, I'm not sure there's going to be rigor in the opposition in some quarters. Thinking of slinking around, by the way, it's really wonderful to watch Mitt Romney lose every element of his dignity, being played around with as though he's being brought out of the closet, put in his high heels, told to walk around the room twice and go back in the closet. If he names Mitt the Secretary of State, it will be the final statement of contempt, because where you don't want to be a Secretary of State if you do not have a completely tight connection with the President of the United States, and Mitt Romney will not.
Becky?
I'll jump in here, and I agree with some of the things that have been said. Now, I think there's been some really good points, and I can't really add anything with the sort of traditional question of the checks and balances, but what I would like to throw into the mix is the idea of federalism as a check and balance on the presidency and really everything that's going on in Washington. And what we've seen over the last 8 dozen years is with the gridlock in Washington, we've seen a real strength from the state level. You know, if you look back at the 17 Republican candidates, I forget, but a lot of them were governors. And so, you know, when you look at the leadership across the country, a lot of this is being found at the gubernatorial level. A lot of the innovation has been taking place in the states. With the Trump presidency, he has said that he believes in more authority at the state level. so that I think we'll see that rise even more so. You know, if you look back on some of these lawsuits that have been filed on various and sundry issues, many states have joined those. There have been, you know, 10, 12, and I think in some of those lawsuits, 28 states have joined lawsuits in federal lawsuits from some of these constitutional questions that are at the national level. So from the checks and balances, I just would like to sort of introduce that idea of federalism and a lot of push up from the states that I think will also be a check and a balance at the federal level.
All right. There are a series of questions here about the media, and I'll one of them says, why does the mainstream media seem reluctant to criticize the president-elect? There's a question here about how much did the footage and the coverage of Hillary Clinton, her near fainting and other issues, hurt her image and credibility with the voters? And then there's a question here that I suspect is targeting me. What will the UNC School of Media and Journalism do to raise the bar for political coverage? Well,
what will you do?
I'll be happy to meet you outside and talk about that. But I would like to. Bill Marshall mentioned it as part of his opening a list of takeaways from the election. But there clearly is we are in the process of a great reckoning within the national news media about how the campaign was covered. Or miscovered, and my own view is that it's not just a matter of whether the media saw what was coming, because it's not really the job just to regurgitate the polls and project, but whether what underneath that did the media, where did the media fall short or not so short in just really explaining the characteristics of this election. Bill, you want to elaborate on where and Hodding's
not,
been
he's
a
not
new...
a, he's not a journal. Oh, you, the journalist. That's,
okay. No, Hodding, go ahead.
I just want to say something.
Hodding's been
My memory is better on this than some of yours. After every election, they gather up at the Kennedy School and here and there, and they all run around saying, oh, we messed it up this time. We're not going to do it again. We're not going to get... However they think they messed it up, they talk about how they messed it up. And occasionally they have, and occasionally they haven't. In this case, who is the media? I mean, who are going to be having these conferences? What's left of big time, and I'm talking about print, okay? Who's left who's really doing serious work? And it's not because I think that they are cowards or idiots. I'm asking who's left? I mean, you can't cover a story if you don't have reporters to cover it. And you all know what the employment levels are in the remaining print media? I sold a paper in Mississippi about 40 years ago, and the guy who bought it now owns 28. He has fewer people working for those 28 papers than I had on my one. You have to hear me clearly because I'm telling you the truth. Now, these are small town papers. But it doesn't matter. That's supposed to be the very model of how you go about the business of making a community work, having journalism working to cover what's going on. A lot of us in the business, just to be honest about it, really love coming to panels like this, and we really hate doing the hard, dirty business of covering the facts. We like to theorize a lot. And going out there and actually digging in and coming back out and providing you with a few facts along with our organizing principles is a thing that's going to be less and less probable, certainly in the print world. I want everybody to close their eyes and pray a minute. Pray for the continued existence of the New York Times. And why? Not because you have to love the New York Times, but because so much of what passes for news in this world is derivative. If it weren't for the Times, God knows what would be out there in many a subject, either leading the way, suggesting a way, or providing it. Somebody tell me sometime what you think. Bill, what are the good newspapers left? Either Bill.
Yeah. Washington Post, which yeah, I think sure. is a lot better than the New York Times, actually. I think the New York Times has lost its keel. It's okay some of the time, but I think the Washington Post is probably the best newspaper out there. But I don't think, to follow up on your point, Hunting, I think the problem is who is left. The problem is even if there were a lot of people left, that's not what people are reading. They're reading what they're getting on Facebook. They're reading what they're getting on Twitter. They're getting it filtered by people who they want to get it filtered by. They're getting it made up. I mean, I'm sure you've all seen these stories of fake news. They're getting it made up, and they like it because that's what they expect. They want to hear that. They want to hear the worst possible thing about the political opponent that they don't like, and they're perfectly happy to spread it, and they're not particularly interested in reading things that are challenging their own particular worldview. And the way that media is disseminated right now makes it real easy to ignore anything that you don't want to hear or discount it even if you do hear it. And the fact is that certain kinds of media, the Rush Limbaughs of the world, had done an amazing job on discrediting the mainstream media, so that even when they are doing objective reporting, it gets treated as if they're just making it up. I mean, that was Stephen Colbert's brilliant technique on truthiness when he gave that wonderful speech at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. We're not interested in truth, we're interested in truthiness, with what conforms to us. And, you know, the person who described this thing, the person we should be looking at is Walt Kelly, right? In Pogo, he said, "We have met the enemy and they are us." Because we're the ones who are doing this.
You're talking about those of us who actually prefer to see the fake news. No, I mean, come on, guys. I mean, how many of you all turn regularly to get your news from your social media? You think what you see about... Wrong crowd. I mean, sorry. But what I nonetheless want to ask something is, what is this sea change in which we finally have an electorate filled with people who wish to be faked? Is that something new? Just came out over the last 10 years, the last 15, the last 25? I mean, are we now fundamentally a different people? And sitting at a university function, the instinct is to say, yeah, they are. They are. I don't buy it. I do buy that the form of communication has changed in such a way that, as in the day with any idiot with a shirt full of type, could start a newspaper, and not knowing anything about journalism and not knowing anything about truth, but knowing about needing to make a buck. And we ran a country for a very long time with extraordinarily primitive news and somehow did not lose the republic. And we're in the early days of a transition of form and platform, as they like to say. But you don't know the results of this right now. But if it is finding such a tremendous appetite, it's yours. It's yours. Come on, folks. It's yours.
Becky, you appear on TV from time to time, and you write for publication. What is your take on the media's relationship with the president-elect and how it was treated during the campaign?
Well, I mean, it's a tough issue, and I don't know the answer. I mean, I don't disagree with the points that you've made. I particularly like yours of, you know, the enemy is us, and that, you know, we ought to demand and expect better standards, and we ought not pay for or use those that aren't. But it's, you know, it's a hard thing to do. And, you know, there's great things about the internet and the access and the way that we can all communicate. But the problem with it is, you know, it used to be that, you know, crazy people just stayed in the basement and, you know, kind of talked to themselves. Well, now crazy people stay in the basement and they get on the internet and they talk to each other and, you know, it whips it into all these, you know, fake news sites. But, you know, I don't know what to do. I mean, you know, to your comment, I practice media a lot. And, you know, all I can do is my part to try to be honest and try to be forthright and try to have a certain standard. And, you know, I guess we should just challenge all of us in this room that, you know, we should do that and hopefully it'll spread. And, you know, if we demand better, we should be able to get it.
We've got about 10 minutes left. One of the questions here are specifically ask you to talk about the frictions and fault lines in our country between urban and rural, between college-educated and non-college-educated folks. What did we learn about our country and the state of its people and its civil society?
Hi.
I always look to political science teachers.
Thanks. So what did we learn? I think we're still learning it. So I don't think we have a lot of clear answers on these questions yet. But as much as we want to set aside, and we can set aside, to the points made earlier, some of the reasons that Trump won and maybe try to turn it back to the economy, there are clearly divides out there. And it's probably true that the Democratic Party has spent a lot of time focusing on the urban poor voter or the urban middle class voter and less time focusing on the rural middle class voter. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. It'll be interesting to see how education plays out. It'll be interesting to see how gender plays out. I think right before the election, and this is totally anecdotal, and Hodding might even be a better person to share some of his Southern stories, but I'm married to someone who is from Alabama, and he is a first-generation college student. His mom never finished high school, nor did his father. And in talking to his mother right before the election, who still lives in Alabama, she said to me something that has resonated, and she has said, I was okay voting for him being Barack Obama, of course, and she is a racist, but she said, I will never vote for a woman for president. That is not what a woman should do. And again, sure, there is a patriarchy, it is real. Sure, there are misogynists, they are real too. But these are divides that do divide America, even if we just want to talk about economic issues, because they separate us. And we don't move forward as a country, though, until we stop trying to be separated by them. Right? So we need to do a better job, especially elite liberals need to do a better job of not of not saying to people like my mother-in-law that they are racists or that they are misogynists, right? We need to do a better job of listening and of understanding. I would point to a book in political science by Kathy Kramer, who is a professor at the University of Wisconsin, who has recently had a lot of attention paid to her since Wisconsin turned red in this presidential election. And what she does as a political scientist is not sort of mainstream political science, but she goes around and just listens to conversations. So she invites herself into church halls and into supper clubs and into polka parties, and she tries to figure out how people are talking about politics. And it's a great read because it is about rural Wisconsin for the most part. And it gives you an insight just into how a different person is seeing the world. And not until we take ourselves out of our ivory towers and we start to think about these different contrasts between people, can we actually move forward as a country? Because the divide right now is real, but the divide is somewhat self-inflicted. And so once we overcome that, and once we really listen to what the middle class voter wants, if the voter wants training, if the voter wants to learn more about other opportunities, or if the voter really does just want a wall, we need to listen to that and take it seriously and not just laugh it off.
As a liberal from Greenville, Mississippi, surrounded growing up with liberals, in which all of my cousins, all of my aunts and uncles were people who could be equally described as you described your husband's family, I appreciate fully the amount of human sympathy to which they are entitled. They're not entitled to take that same point of view and stick it down the nose of those who are their neighbors or ought to be their neighbors, and to do what they did classically. Because we are not just now into a suddenly divided nation. We have been a divided nation, but we didn't give a good goddamn. We didn't care about blacks for 150 years. Give me a break. You fine Yankees walked away from the Civil War and let us win it again down there. Remember? Because you didn't care anything about black folks. God knows we didn't care anything about women. I mean, it was the way it went. We had a civil war because we were so desperately divided on some issues. I'm sorry, we were desperately divided enough. We have been a divided nation. One of the reasons we managed to pull it through, if I may just push this one a little further, is that our parties were, in fact, much more in the neighborhood of big tents than they were into sectarian gathering places in which every little group got to get their little thing in and there would be no sort of overall. And so when Tom Dewey lost to Harry Truman, my father, having decided he was a Republican, made up some joke about how wonderful it was to be a party that's winning, in which you had Hubert Humphrey marching down the aisle holding hands with Jim Eastland of Mississippi, and so on. That's true. It was. It was a party which held together in one place a lot of different kinds of folks. As a result, not because those different kinds of folks would give you their votes all that much, but because they gave you the majority in the House and in the Senate, some things got done that weren't going to get done. Now, I would really look forward to the day in which the first conversation was going to be about shared assumptions about what are the most important things for a party and a presidency to do. Am I supposed to care most about how, oh no, I'm not going to get nasty here. Just name any numbers, particular interests. Or am I supposed to be looking for something that actually appeals to 65% of the people? I mean, and we got to do some reconstruction, because if we think that political parties are essentially associations of AKs in which you either win or you shoot the people as you lose or vice versa, if we can't reconstruct the idea of compromise, if we can't reconstruct the idea of big tents as opposed to one thing after another, I don't care about the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. I care about the Republic. This is too big a nation with too much real division to run our politics as though the point of it all was division. And that is what's really scary about Trump. At their worst, his predecessors in that office in my time have been people who at least pretended to be people who cared about something larger than just the particular little narrow range of issues that were there in front of them. I mean, even the worst of them didn't come within light years of being Donald Trump, okay? At all. You think they did, but go look at them. Ronald Reagan? George Bush the Younger? I mean, people I find to be wrong in most of their policies, but they sure as hell were not people who were just simply out there playing the go get them, grab them, stick them, and get at it for the interest of this pig 1% that actually run this country.
There are been a whole series of storylines in the time since the election. And one of them is that there are a lot of good folk in the hinterland who have not been listened to and have been treated in a patronizing fashion. And that we, if we stop doing this, we will heal our differences. Well, I've no quarrel with the notion of listening to people and reaching out to them. But you know what? There's a lot of racism still in this country and a lot of ugliness that was expressed by Trump and that exists there. A lot of misogyny. And all of our talk about other aspects of the election shouldn't overlook this. This is what we've lived with all of these months. We shouldn't be forgetting that. And that there have been, as Harding was saying, that there are differences in this country is nothing new. There have long been an urban-rural conflict. This is what populism, what William Jennings Bryan's campaign was about. There have long been class differences, but there has been a a deepening of whatever the opposite of civil discourse is, uncivil a discourse of a sort we truly have never seen before. This has been a terribly ugly year, and I don't think that is something that, to use President Obama's words, ought to be the new normal. It's something we need to reject, and we hope that our fellow Americans, wherever they are, will reject.
Yeah. We're going to run over a few minutes because I want to give you, or at least read, a series of questions that kind of roll one after the other that bear on what Hodding and Bill have just said. One of them asks us to think about the 8 stages of grief and what we think about it. One of them asks, what's wrong with the American people? Another one asks, where do we go from here? Another one asks simply, what now? But this series of questions ends with, give examples of positive actions we can take. I'm not sure that we all have an answer for that, but I thought those series of questions that several of you wrote independently of each other just kind of gives a sense of, certainly the mind of this room to some extent and the mind of what people are thinking about today. Just what do we do now and what is
famous man in my hometown named William Alexander Percy was talking to my dad right before the start of World War II, and Dad says, well, what are we going to do about this? And he says, there's not much we can do in our little towns about what is happening in Europe or in Washington even, but we can do one heck of a lot about what happens in our Greenville. And it is the decisions that are made in the Greenvilles which can ultimately affect and influence and finally shape what it is that happens in the Jacksons and the Washingtons and indeed abroad. So my answer to myself, because otherwise I get fatally depressed, is to say, go back to first principles. Whatever you think is important, find the organization, find the cause, find the people who are working on that where you are and go to work on it. Because what is really necessary is, of course, to withdraw. I mean, necessary for the triumph of evil, as they like to say, is for the withdrawal of us from that kind of engagement in our search for the perfect magic bullet that will kill the zombie, because ain't nothing going to kill this zombie anytime soon. And he's going to be chewing everything that comes up in front of him because he means it. Oh, he doesn't know what he's saying, but he means what it means. No, I mean, he means what it means. That we, in the very top, shall feast. And we are not going to be able to deal with him there. So deal with him here. And the him is the it, which infuses so much of what has been translated into votes.
Bill Marshall.
I think I started my comments by saying that one of the lessons I don't want us to have is that there are 60 million bad people in the world, in the United States, no matter where we started on. And I think we need to work on that. I was just thinking now, I forget which one of the Tropic books it was, whether it was Tropic of Cancer or Tropic of Capricorn, but the main character keeps going into bars and talking about Nietzsche to everybody who's there. I think we all need to go into bars in part of the country and talk to people who we don't agree with. Because just talking to ourselves isn't going to work. It's not working. And we need to do that. So that would be, I mean, I think that's what Hodding is saying at a different level, but I think we need to do that, because if we don't, this division is going to continue.
Just for the record, I'm the one guy in this room that goes into bars regularly.
No, you're not.
All over the country with all kinds of people.
I agree with.
Here to go to one.
I certainly agree with what Bill said, and I would just pick up on that a little bit, is that, you know, I think we need to talk to people. I think that we need to talk to people that we don't agree with, but I also think that we need to argue and we need to discuss, and I think that that debate and those discussions, and, you know, I don't have a problem with passion getting involved in things, but with this terrible ugliness that you mentioned, yeah, you know, that we've all experienced over the last year, I think many of us are just, can't we just all get along? But I don't know that that's really the answer, that, you know, I think these factions and discussion and different opinions is healthy, and I think it's good, and I think it's the American way. So I just hope that we don't get away, don't hope that a reaction to this very ugly campaign is that we don't want to talk about those things that are important and those tough issues, and to really get those out and talk to people in a very respectful way. But I think that's what makes us great, and that's what's going to continue to make us great, and that's what's going to make us move forward.
Well, that's great. One while you were talking, I was thinking, you know, that a little bit of self advertisement here, you know, that I'm a co-founder of a new news organization to kind of fill the gap, you know, one of these newly emergent organizations that have arisen to fill the gaps with the diminishment of newspapers. It's called Education NC at nc.org. I wrote a series of columns during the campaign about the role of schools in reinvigorating civics education, history, political science, and we need to be aware of our responsibility at a university to be a place for the kind of debate that Becky's talking about, for a reinvigorating of the notion that our schools are places that forge the future of America by educating students to understand constitutional principles, to have the right kind of scrutiny of people in power. And so, you know, schools are not going to turn the country around immediately, but we can't ignore our own responsibility as a public university here too. So I want to thank all of you for being here. You were a great audience, and thank you for all the questions that you sent in, and thanks to Doug Dibbert for his leadership.
Farrell has, in typical fashion, thanked everybody except himself. So let's all thank Farrell. There was a word that all of our panelists used in one form or another, and it's the word listen. And we're grateful to each of you for coming and listening. We know that there's a lot of listening yet to be done. Abraham Lincoln once said, "To sin by silence makes cowards of men." So we don't have to be silent while we're at the same time listening. And hopefully each of us recognizes that we can each occasionally be wrong. So thank you again for coming. Thank our panelists one more time. Yeah.